recapping where we were last time. We introduced killing horizons and bifurcated killing horizons in particular. So a killing horizon is a null surface whose null generator is the restriction to the surface of a killing vector field of the ambient spacetime. So this is the sky. And a bifurcated killing horizon is a pair of such killing horizons intersecting at a codimension 2 surface C. And the important thing is that both surfaces must be killing horizons for the same vector field. So why do we care about these objects is due to the fact that black hole, in fact, in many interesting situations, hide such a bifurcated killing horizon in a way that now I will explain. We also introduced for killing horizons a quantity called kappa, the surface gravity. A way to introduce it is as follows. So the norm of the killing vector field at the horizon, well, this is all evaluated at the horizon, vanishes, as we said, because it's a null killing vector field there. Well, it becomes null at the surface, like here. And so this is null. So what is interesting to look at is the derivative of this quantity at k. Since it's null everywhere on the surface, this should be proportional to the normal to the surface, which being null is also the tangent. And the proportionality constant is kappa. And there is this theorem by Bardeen Carter, that says that the zeroth law that says that kappa is constant on the horizon. Okay, so this is a crucial fact. Now, the constancy of kappa along the null rays here is kind of easy to prove, starting from the definition. So the true content of this is that the kappa on different null rays is the same. And this is, you can think of it as an equilibrium condition, hence this zeroth law. We will also see that kappa has interpretation of a temperature for other reasons, but for now, this is it. And this kappa is the surface gravity. It's called the surface gravity of the horizon. Good. Now, we mentioned that if we have this analogy with between kappa and temperature, we expect kappa equals zero to be a degenerate situation. And indeed, this is the case. If kappa equals zero, the associated black hole, well, a black hole with zero surface gravity is an extremal black hole, which is unstable. So the following theorem. Yes.
So how these theorems are proved? Like, say, take like particular solution or?
No, I believe they're proved on what? Which ones? The.
So, for example, like on the horizon. So how do they do it? Or do they start from general definitions? And
so these type of theorems, they usually come in two flavors, one for killing horizons, and then you introduce some symmetry hypotheses, for example, the Araxi symmetric and so on, and then you can deduce these kind of things. Or vice versa, I mentioned last time the rigidity theorems that say that a stationary black hole is necessarily axisymmetric, and therefore It also carries these kind of solutions. Well, sorry, and for those black holes, one can also prove these kind of results. And there, what you're using as an extra input is the Einstein's equations themselves. So in one case, they are purely geometrical statements about null surfaces with certain symmetries. On the other hand, these null surfaces are realized thanks to the Einstein's equation in certain conditions. But they're pretty general, So they don't look at Kerr solution. They are more abstract. So this is another theorem that has this flavor. It says that if let me first remind this rigidity theorem then. These rigidity theorems say basically that for a stationary black hole with other technical hypotheses, but for a stationary black hole, the event horizon is a Killing horizon. For which Killing vector field? Well, a Killing vector field that takes this form. So these are Killing vector fields that encode the stationarity. So this is a time translation at infinity, and this is the rotation vector field at infinity. So it's stationary and axisymmetric as a consequence of, well, it's stationary by hypothesis and axisymmetric as a consequence. So axisymmetry. And furthermore, there is this Killing vector field for some constant omega h, which is called the angular velocity of the black hole, so of the horizon. So this is saying how much the black hole is spinning. So even though we have two a priori Killing vector field, there is one special combination of them that makes the horizon a Killing horizon. So this is the guy we will be interested in using later. And there is this theorem by Wall that says that now, since we have a Killing horizon, we can compute, we have, again, a stationary black hole with kappa different from zero. This is our hypothesis. And if this is the case, then the maximally extended space-time representing this black hole associated to the stationary black hole in the event horizon H is a branch of a bifurcate Killing horizon. Okay, so this requires some unpacking. Once again, we are in the setup of this other theorem with the extra hypothesis that we have this non-degeneracy condition, so the surface gravity is non-zero. Then the idea is the following. We have an astrophysical black hole, which is formed, for example, by collapse of a shell. This has, as we drew last time, asymptotic infinity over here in the future. This is asymptotic infinity in the past. This is our singularity of the, and this is the event horizon, and this is the black hole region. Now, the idea here is that at late time, this black hole will settle down to a stationary black hole. Everything will have been radiated away, and so at late time, we get a stationary solution. Of course, this is an approximation, that it will not be fully stationary, but to an extremely good approximation, it will become stationary. And at that point, I at late times, there will be a time-like Killing vector field T. I can apply this theorem, therefore, at late time, that there will be also, will also be axis symmetric. And as a consequence, at late time, this portion of the horizon will be a Killing horizon. Now, the idea here is to extend this thing backwards to the maximally extended spacetime that contains the same symmetries. So using this, this is the extension, maximal extension. I can reconstruct a spacetime that rather looks like this. Okay, so so this region up here is the same as the other one, but this one has been completed by using the symmetries. So in particular, I have this this is chi, which is built like that, and so this is the situation. And now we see that what used to be the event horizon over here becomes the future branch of a bifurcated Killing horizon. So is it clear how this is constructed? So this is not the spacetime representing the history of the black hole. Is not. This is how the black hole is formed, but the final state geometry of this process, if I extend it backwards by using all its symmetries, I get something much more symmetric, much more, which is, in fact, this is time reversal, has time reversal symmetry, but this guy doesn't. But so in a sense, this the structure here is a property of the final state of the black hole. So it's a way to encode to describe whatever we say about the spacetime over here is something that we're saying about the final state of the black hole and not about its formation. Does it make sense? Okay, so.
So the time reversal black hole is the white hole?
Yeah. This is the this would be called the white hole region. Yeah. This down here, because from here, nothing can stay in here. Here, the idea was that nothing can come out to infinity. But here is the opposite. Here, if I trace back, how to say? Yeah, in any case, it's the complement. This is the complementary region of the past of asymptotic future infinity, and this is the complementary region of the future of the past asymptotic infinity. Yeah, so this is black hole, and this is the white hole region. So now the idea is to use all these extra properties that our bifurcation surface has to say something about the stationary final state of a black hole. Now, the last lemma that we need, this is proven in the lecture notes, is not super hard. like these are hard theorems. This lemma is kind of, it's just a bit of geometry. At C, at the bifurcation surface, we have that this Killing vector field, the derivative of the Killing vector field is given by the area by vector times kappa. So this is a very nice formula. So this is anti-symmetric, and we know that the symmetric part of this is zero because it's a Killing. So this is a sanity check, and the proportionality constant is kappa. Okay. Good. Now, we want to, as I said, we want to study this. As I mentioned last time briefly, these points over here, I think I mentioned it in any case, these points over here are a little singular because that's where the conformal compactification is trying to squeeze space-like infinity, which is, if you want, the limit r going to infinity for all possible times into a point. So this point is extremely singular, as is a priori this one. So any space-like slice in these diagrams ends up there. So it's clear that this is not really a point. So what one does is to resolve it with some hyperboloid like that. So now what we want to do is to take, it's not super important that this is more like a detail about the way I'm drawing things. Now we will consider a Cauchy surface like this one in this extended spacetime as a way to study the properties of the late time black hole. So this hinges on the bifurcation surface here and on a sphere at infinity on the other end. Now we okay. So now let me write it like this. This is the formula we're after. Now delta n minus the j, where this is the ADM mass or energy of the black hole. This is the angular momentum. And in fact, this is the interpretation of what in reality is, well, maybe I write it here, T delta S is kappa delta its area. So as we said, there is an analogy between the temperature and the surface gravity and the entropy and the area. Now, what is the delta that we, how do we interpret this delta? So this delta here, there are different ways of thinking about it. If you read, for example, Carroll's book, what he has in mind is we have a black hole, which is stationary for a certain time, then we throw something in, things change, and resettle down to another stationary state, and I'm comparing these two stationary states. Here, what I will do instead is to compare two different stationary black hole in the two different final states of two different stationary black hole, which are close in phase space. So it's more in the spirit of the virtual works of Feynman, if you are familiar with that, but in any case, is two different solutions in phase space. So this delta is this differential in phase space for me. And the equation I want to deduce this from is this flow equation. that we wrote down last time. Now, deduce from. So the question is how we do it. So the obvious idea is that why this makes sense. I mentioned it last time, but briefly, this charge, if I set psi equal chi, which is t plus omega h phi, we see that we could expect that the neutral charge of t and phi is m and j. And so there is this delta in front. So maybe we are going in the right direction. But what more specifically, what should we expect? So in this way, this is the idea. This gives m, this gives j. But there are a few subtleties. This Q sigma, in fact, what happens is that it is the integral over sigma of the constraint, if you remember this formula. So this is the constraint, so that this will go to zero on shell, plus what is left is the boundary, piece of J. Okay, so now since we're working with solutions to the Einstein's equation, this will go to zero and this will go to zero. So we are left with only boundary integrals at the boundary of sigma, but this boundary of sigma is two components. So this is what I want to mention now. Okay. Okay, so let me think how is best to proceed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it's better to point out before jumping into the computation, point out one more subtlety. So this subtlety is that chi is a Killing. So it satisfies the equation GAB equal to zero. But what happens if I take the variation of this formula? If I vary g alone, I will not get zero again. So the killing depends on the choice of the metric. So if I'm this means that necessarily delta chi is different from zero, because this must be true for all the black hole spacetime I'm considering, right? So I'm not saying that every metric has a killing, but in the family of metric that we're interested in, which are this black hole metric, there will be such a killing. But this killing depends on the specific black hole I'm looking at. In particular, omega will depend on the black hole I'm looking at. So this is different from the situation we saw when we wrote that formula. There, psi was just a parameter and things were going in and out without any issue. the delta was delta xi was zero by construction. So how does that equation gets modified in this more general situation where we are choosing different vector fields for different metrics? How does the Hamiltonian flow equation change? Generalizes, maybe, is a better way. Okay, so it generalizes as follows. I rho chi omega equal to, and here I will explain in a second what I mean by this. And then the rest, it's unchanged. Oops. So this means that first I take the variation as if for a generic vector field, and only at the end I plug in the vector field. So there is no delta chi appearing anywhere because it doesn't appear on the left-hand side. This is outside any variation. It doesn't appear here, so it better doesn't appear here either. So one can prove it independently, but this is a way to see that this is the only meaningful way to generalize that equation. So this is the equation we want to use, and now we start seeing why the omega is sitting outside those variations. That this point starts making sense because we are not varying chi in this formula. We are varying everything else. Okay, now from this, we can start, working out the different pieces. And so let me remind that this will be on shell. Since we're interested about a on shell statement, this becomes minus delta, so this is little q is the integral of little j, this is the boundary term we said. So I just call this little q. So there are two pieces to little q, one at C and one at infinity. The bulk part goes to zero because it's constraints, it's equations of motion. This term goes to zero because, again, it's equations of motion. And then we are left with this piece. Now, this piece, we know, okay, let me write it like this. C at I chi theta plus the same integral at infinity of the same. Now, one, we have that, let's remember what rho chi is. Rho chi is the vector field that by definition takes a metric and changes it by its lead derivative. But we see that since this is a Killing vector field, this is precisely zero. So this is something we haven't really considered in gauge theories earlier. But what can happen is that certain gauge transformations stabilize certain configurations. So this is exactly what is going on. We're always choosing a very special vector field for each metric we're looking at, which is one that is a symmetry for that metric. It doesn't change it. So these are called stability parameters, stabilizers, or reducibility parameters. And what they mean is that they are kind of degenerate in field space. So this is zero. And this means that the left-hand side of my equation will also be zero. So we start to see that many terms go away. and this is one. Then two, remember that chi at a bifurcation surface vanishes. Why? Well, because chi, you see, is changing direction there. So it better vanishes. Which means that this integral will be zero. Because this is just a quantity proportional to chi. This is just a contraction of chi a with the index of theta a. So this goes to zero. So this integral of I chi theta at c vanishes. Good. So we have, we're left with not very many terms. Putting these together, we get zero on shell is equal to minus delta q c. Now, what is chi? Well, I'll do it in two steps. So just to make it a bit clearer, s infinity plus integral at infinity of this other one. So now I want to split chi into its two pieces, t and phi. In fact, at the bifurcation surface, I just keep chi because is the Killing vector field adapted to my Killing horizon, so it will be easier to work with this expression as a one piece. But at infinity, we associate different meanings to the time translation charge and the rotation charge. So that's where we want to split them. And here we get delta q at infinity of t. Well, let me start from omega, in fact. This is the one for phi a, minus delta q at infinity of t, plus there is this ugly piece here, which has two pieces, t and phi. Now remember, this piece also goes to zero because phi is tangent to my sphere at infinity. So these type of integrals are non-vanishing only when the vector field is transverse to the surface we're looking at. So this is also zero because phi parallel to s infinity is tangent or So we are left with one, two, three, four terms. Now I want, there is a curious remark. The curious remark is that contrary to chi, which depends on which black hole we are looking at, phi at infinity is always the same because this is always rotations in Minkowski. Like this, all this spacetime at infinity asymptote to the same spacetime, which is Minkowski, and this is the same vector field for all of them. So since MGAB tends to Minkowski at infinity, TA, phi A are, and TA and phi A, well, to, in quote, absolute time translations and rotations. By this, I mean that there is nothing depends on G anymore at infinity, so these become field independent. So we have that delta phi A is equal to delta tai ta, so at infinity, at infinity, this quantity are zero. So how they extend in the bulk depends on the solution, but their property at infinity is kind of fixed. So here, since I'm just interested in what is happening at infinity, this can enter my variation. So this implies, for example, that delta q of t is at infinity is delta q of t. So now I can see that this will be delta of an energy, for example. So we can compute these charges for compute now these Comar charges Q of phi at infinity. And this is a computation that has been done. So these Comar charges were known in the 50s, so it's a standard computation. You can do it for Schwarzschild as an exercise to convince yourself. So this will give you the angular momentum. So as usual, my signs at the blackboard, they're not very trustworthy. There are orientations, the two pieces of, so probably I should have changed my signs. I'll just fix it at the end. So, but you can trust that you get the right thing at the end of the day. So this is the angular momentum of the black hole. That's not extremely surprising. Now, of course, one could say this is the definition. However, it's not really good to say that this is a definition. One should check that this notion of angular momentum computed like this satisfies a bunch of consistency checks. And the reason is that, if you remember, these charges, these neutral charges, are ambiguous at the corners. There are lots of ambiguities that enter them. So why this one should be the right choice? It's a priori unclear. So this shouldn't be taken as a definition, but as a somewhat an empirical result out of many different checks that this actually makes sense as a definition of what the angular momentum of a solution is. So you can do it in some Newtonian approximation, check that the prefactors are right. There are lots of checks one can do, and this is right. The reason I'm mentioning this is because, a bit surprisingly, there is this puzzle that here one gets. One half of the expected result. Now, again, the signs, I'm not completely sure. I think there is a minus here and a plus here, but in my notes, it's the opposite. I think it's because I'm messing up orientation somewhere. But in any case, so the important thing is the prefactor, not so much the sign. So here, you get one half of the result that you would like to see. And again, these charges are ambiguous at the boundaries. But T magically comes with another, there is another piece here contributing to it. So the miracle is that thanks to the asymptotic properties of this black hole spacetime. So if you want, these are boundary conditions that we're putting over all the spacetime. We're saying that they're asymptotically flat by definition, all these solutions are asymptotically flat. We can use these extra properties to see that on this subset of solution, this term is actually delta exact. It's not an arbitrary one form. This is at infinity of t theta is actually delta of the integral of some quantity b. It's not, and the integral of b at infinity is another, is what corrects this mass. It's kind of a little miracle. But again, all these quantities are a priori ambiguous. So if you want another way of thinking about this is to say, we are fixing our ambiguities in our definition of the charges, thanks to the boundary conditions that we have to correct the charges in a way that we get the right, what we want. Okay, so it's not that we can put anything as a correction. It has to be consistent, so it's still non-trivial. And in this case, it works out that this term can be reabsorbed into Q. So we have, therefore, summarizing, the delta Q C at chi on shell is exactly equal to delta M minus omega, again, up to sines dj. This is putting things together, right? Because so we are left with computing this term. Now, it's not surprising that what we get is a property of the horizon. So its area and surface gravity can naturally come up in that expression. And I want to stress that this is outside the variation. So this was a source of confusion in the original papers. So it's nice to see that can be made sense of. So I think in one of the first papers on this, they were saying, oh, we need to compare black holes with the same angular velocity, possibly different masses, angular momenta, but the same angular velocity. It's not necessary. It just comes out by itself. So finally, we want to compute this left-hand side. So we start as a warm-up. We compute the charge per se, like without caring if the variation is inside or outside, just compute the Comar charge of these at the horizon. But if you look at your notes, you will see that this becomes dA chi b minus dB chi a epsilon ab. Now, since this is a Killing, the symmetric part of this derivative vanishes. So this is just twice the same quantity. And as I wrote somewhere, I don't see it anymore, but I'm pretty sure. Oh, there, the lemma is that this is 1/2 of dA. Well, this is the lemma is 1/2 kappa. The bivector, so this becomes, now the notation might look a little odd, but this is nothing else than the area element on C. The induced metric times the So this becomes, now we can use the zeroth law, which says that kappa is constant, it comes out. So this contraction has a 2 by yeah. So it just becomes kappa area. But still, we don't want to take the variation of this, because we would get, first we would get delta kappa times delta A, and so delta of the product, not delta of each, kappa delta A. So it's not what we expect, and on top is not what we need to compute, really to compute, because what we need to compute is delta Q evaluated on chi, not delta of Q of chi. So now we start to compute this. We start by looking at this. We notice first. Let me do it in a couple of steps. So we start from the initial expression, which was, let's do it like this. Delta B, delta A, epsilon AB. Next, we see, since this is antisymmetric, you see that if you put the Christoffel symbols, they drop. They cancel each other. So this is, in fact, also dA psi B minus dB psi A. And now, where is the last? So where does G appear now? It doesn't appear in the Christoffel symbols because they're not there. But here I'm lowering an index. So there is a G hiding here, and then there are G's hiding there. These we like because they're those that give us delta area. These we need to take care of. So this is dA of G B C psi C minus the other one, epsilon AB. OK, now we see that if I want to compute delta Q of chi, what I need to compute is 1/4 of dA delta GBC chi C, where this is minus epsilon AB, plus, and here I'm varying this piece, so there's, I can just write it like that, minus the other one, delta epsilon AB. Okay, so now I take into account that here I'm evaluating everything at C. So if this derivative, so since I'm evaluating at C, let me write it, and then we will see why my claim. I claim that I can think of this as this. So this we have already, computed. This was kappa epsilon 1/2 kappa epsilon AB delta epsilon AB. So that's from the previous computation. Here, why I can write it like this? Well, if I compare the two differ by terms proportional to chi, without any derivative acting on chi. Therefore, This means that they vanish because c, because you are at c. So here I'm using that chi at c is zero. So I've tricked, I use this trick to go from here to there and rewrite everything in terms of covariant derivatives. Because here there is will be a gamma times chi, which is proportional to chi, so it goes away. And the other one that I'm missing is the derivative acting on delta g, but then it's proportional to chi again, so it also drops. Now, this I know what it is. This is just kappa epsilon ac. And okay, maybe it's kind of pointless to go through through the details, but you see that there are index structures that are slightly different here and there, but there is a delta g, which is about how I raise and lower the index. So this comes out to be the integral over c of epsilon ac delta epsilon ac. Well, maybe I can write it in a slightly cuter fashion. So this is combining these two. So the delta g is about lowering this index, essentially. Okay. And kappa comes out because of the zeroth law again. So this is. Now, epsilon, let me write it here. This epsilon AB is epsilon AB times this area element. And the point is that epsilon AB, epsilon BA is 2, is identically 2. So combining this, replacing that equation in here, what I see is that, therefore, delta of this is 0. So this, in the end, becomes kappa and is also equal to, 0 is equal to epsilon AB, epsilon BA, which is also 2 epsilon AB delta epsilon BA. Right? It's just. So the epsilon can come out of that, of this delta, and I'm only left with the integral over C of delta square root of gamma, which is kappa. So it's kind of an intricated computation that uses all the ingredients that we spelled out.
Line, like
here? Here?
Yeah, one above. Yeah, what happened to that term?
To this term?
Yeah.
So this is delta of epsilon with an index low.
Yeah, I see.
So I can, you see what? Okay. So there is a delta of an epsilon with the index up and the g comes out. And the other one is delta of is this guy. So none of this step is particularly difficult if you follow it on the notes, but I understand that the blackboard can be a bit confusing. So, okay, so putting everything together, we get kappa outside of the variation is kind of a miracle. Delta A equal delta M minus omega delta J. So kind of the lesson is that these equations contain a lot of information. They can be very subtle based on what kind of diffeomorphism I'm evaluating them on. Here they are field dependent. So I can't just put them inside or outside of variations. And if I do things properly, indeed, I can get out of them some very interesting relationships.
So basically, when, like this black hole thermodynamics is a fully classical result. Is a radiation classical result as well, or is that
smart? Sorry? Oops.
So the black hole thermodynamics.
Okay. The first law of conclusion. I address your question in, right here. So the conclusion is that kappa delta A on shell is equal to delta J, delta M minus omega delta J. So this is the first law of black hole mechanics. And there is no h-bar anywhere in here. So this is just, these laws were discovered by Bardeen and Carter and so on, just by looking at classical GR. Where does the quantum bit enter? Well, it comes in when I want to turn kappa into a temperature and A into an entropy. So A into an entropy is the big mystery, so I will not try to justify it. But the relationship between kappa and temperature, already from a dimensional analysis, kappa is not a temperature. So that's you see there is something off. And then you need maybe something a bit stronger than just the zero law to claim that kappa is a temperature. So this is, there are different ways to get there. The simplest is to look at the Unruh effect, where you have the Killing horizon in Rindler. It has its own surface gravity. And you can indeed have these Unruh de Witt detectors that click at this, which are accelerated. So, okay, maybe this would take me a bit off track, but there is a way to, even for the Rindler horizon as a Killing horizon, to associate the temperature to it in terms of accelerated detectors. But on a black hole, there is this other work of Oakey that says that black hole evaporate and evaporate at a certain temperature. This is a computation of QFT over a curved background. And it says that if you inject a nice enough state into a black hole spacetime, at future null infinity, you will get a thermal spectrum. So at which temperature? At temperature proportional to kappa. Now, I don't want to, I think it's 2 pi kappa. And is it the inverse? No, it's like this. So the right prefactor is 2 pi. There are h bars hiding as well, but I will not put them in. So these you need to compute by some other, this argument is not enough. And if you do this, you see that what you would call the black hole entropy is area over 2 pi. Now, why am I not getting a 4? I'm not getting a 4 because I put my Planck length to be 8 pi g h bar and not g h bar. If I put back the 8 pi g, this becomes a 4. The 8 pi. I find this prettier. It seems 2 pi more natural than a 4, but it's related to the fact that this temperature has some geometric origin in the theory of modular flows and so on. So it kind of fits a bit better the general theory. One very last remark about this, so then we are done. J is in all the, from the beginning I've been seeing the J is like a momentum map. And momentum maps are equivariant or covariant but not invariant. So this was expressed in these, well, here I get a minus because, right? There are, so the Noether charge, in a way, the Noether current is not an invariant object, it's an equivariant object. So this is not zero. However, but for chi Killing, and this is, as we saw, is field dependent. So L rho psi of chi is not zero, cannot be zero, because it depends on the metric. J chi is fully invariant. So this is a completely invariant quantity. So these J's, these charges that we're looking at, they are they don't depend on their invariant of the theory. They are good charges. They are gauge invariant. The mystery is that there is also a term that rho here is not just it in J, as in this formula. Rho is also it in chi, and chi kind of transforms in the opposite way. And this cancels. So this, I could do the proof. You just use the fact that delta chi has to satisfy the equation coming out of that lead derivative. You plug it back in and you see what comes out. So, Q of chi is a gauge invariant or a diff invariant . This is not true for these guys in general, but it's true for this one evaluated on a killing. Okay, so I wanted to end on this remark, where one has to be careful about what kind of charges are truly invariant, which other ones are instead. The point is that I can, chi is a property of the metric. These other psi's are just, in a sense, I know that I told you not to think of them as changes of coordinate systems, but could just be about how you represent your metric in different coordinates, whereas the chi is given. I give you the metric in any coordinate system, and then you can decide whether there is the appropriate chi or not, and how to write it in that coordinate system, and they're tied together, whereas these guys are just whatever, in a sense. Okay? Thanks.